with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deeper dive into the issues that you care about with people that you want to hear from. And today I'm very excited to have a dear friend and special guest by the name of Dinesh D'Souza, who you all know from his wonderful podcast, from all of his movies, his great work and commentary. And to have him on a topic that he actually covered earlier this week on his podcast. And so I'd encourage you to listen to that episode as well. This was from Tuesday of this past week, the last week in May, talking about the future of the Republican Party, where we're at as conservatives, and most of us here, you know, are Republicans. Personally, I am as well, even though I'm not actually registered as a Republican. But that's a little bit longer conversation. but overall, we should be championing the Republican Party doing conservative things. And that's what Elon Musk wanted to do, right? When he took a very personal financial hit, a career hit, and was willing to stand up for the Trump administration to help get Trump elected, to go and help Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency. And he seems incredibly disillusioned now by saying, you know, basically he's taking a step back and he didn't get done everything that he wanted to with Doge. And to think about that for a moment, that the richest man or one of the most wealthy men in the world, who has this kind of unprecedented access to the most powerful office in the world, trying to do a minor thing like Department of Government Efficiency. If he can't accomplish that and feels disillusioned with everything that he's been exposed to, knows, and has a power in his own right to do, what does that say about our government, about the state of America, but also about whether elections really matter, actually? So let's welcome in Dinesh D'Souza. And Dinesh, this was a great conversation that you had on your podcast. And so I appreciate you joining now to kind of extend that conversation, because I think this is a really critical point.
Absolutely, Jenna. Delighted to be joining you and, you know, to sort of answer your question about whether elections matter. I think they do. And in a weird way, what we might be looking at here is not even a problem with the Republican Party, but to some degree, a problem with the electorate itself. Now, here's what I mean. Elon Musk is disillusioned. Why? Because his team has identified this whole array of flagrant and obvious abuses, waste, fraud, absurd allocations of money. Now, the Doge team has been successful temporarily in blocking, cutting, in some cases dismantling agencies like USAID. So it's not as if Doge has not accomplished anything. But there was the hope, which I think Elon Musk shared, that the government could move closer to a balanced budget. It just is untenable to keep adding to this $36, $38 trillion debt, to take in $3.5 trillion every year and spend $5 or $6 trillion. I mean, this is just a formula. This is just a kind of madness. And so there was the expectation that we can kind of bring this into line. One way to do that would be simply for Congress to institutionalize these cuts, partly so that no future president can undo them. While they're being done at the behest of Trump, they're very temporary, and they can easily be changed with essentially the stroke of a pen. So the mystery here is, why haven't the Republicans, who control both houses of Congress, although somewhat narrowly, moved to do this? I think this is really what's frustrating Musk. And I think the answer to the question is that apart from a small minority of Republicans in the House, the majority do not support significant spending cuts. Or at least, to put it somewhat differently, they're happy to have spending cuts in somebody else's district, but not in their own district. And so the reason for this, I believe, is that unfortunately, over the past 75 years, the American people, including a lot of Republicans, have become somewhat habituated to getting benefits from the government. And I'm not just talking about Social Security or Medicare. I'm saying farmers are used to getting paid not to grow things. And people are used to getting jobs for projects that don't really matter or that take forever to carry out. Consulting firms are used to getting contracts that never expire. And so all of this kind of built-in waste and incrustation in the federal budget is proving extremely difficult to cut and to dismantle. It's almost as if, you know, once you start giving people these benefits, it's much, much harder to take them away.
Yeah, and this, I think, elucidates, Dinesh D'Souza, the problem that we have with essentially the uniparty in D.C. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember reading the book from Barry Goldwater, The Conscience of a Conservative. I mean, well after the fact, I think it was originally published in like 1960. So you know, this would have been 24 years before I was even born. But even back then, he was talking about how Republicans were no longer economically, fiscally responsible, and they wanted to spend taxpayer money as a non-revenue generating institution. The government, you know, is they wanted to spend all of the money on their own pet projects rather than recognizing the limits, the limitations that are fiscally responsible conservatism. And we're seeing that challenge that he was writing about in the 1960s now, 60 years later, being even way, way worse. And the Republicans have bought into all of this kind of hook, line, and sinker. And so the interesting thing, if we can for a moment critique or perhaps even criticize the first Trump administration, Trump added to the federal deficit. I mean, he's not, by and large, a fiscally conservative individual. And so it sort of begs the question why he wouldn't want to get us, meaning America, on strong financial footing, and why this whole big, beautiful bill, as Rand Paul and Chip Roy and Thomas Massie and former Representative Bob Good, I mean, they're all sounding some alarm bells on this. Why Trump has this posture and is going along with a lot of these Republicans that are continuing this reckless spending when DOGE should have been the signature agenda item of this second administration?
Well, let me try to give you how I think the Trump people are thinking about it and how they would, you know, hypothetically answer what you just said. They would say, look, Goldwater might have been right in principle, but notice that he lost the 1964 election by a landslide. So the American people did not choose his path, even though he put it forward. In came Reagan, and noticed that Reagan behaved a lot more like Trump. By that I mean Reagan did not cut, certainly not significantly, any kind of government spending. What Reagan did was cut taxes. He did privatization. He did deregulation. But he was not able to, and in fact, he didn't even try very hard to cut federal spending. I think the Trump people would say, we're trying to follow a somewhat similar path. By that I mean we're trying to draw in some revenues from tariffs. We're going to try to do tax cuts. We're going to try to ignite the engine of economic growth. We're trying to become the world leader in robotics and artificial intelligence. We're trying to draw a lot of foreign capital in the United States to boost productivity and growth. So the Trump formula, which may or may not work, is we're going to try to grow our way out of this. Now, I do think that that's partially true, but I also think that they have not given sufficient attention. I think Trump could get a better bill through than the one that we have here. And I think that some of the people in the Senate are pushing to make changes that will at least move us in that direction.
And I think you're absolutely right on how his advisors and these people are viewing this and framing it. And I also agree with you, Dinesh, that we could have had a much stronger bill than the one that we have. Do you think that that is primarily or maybe equally the fault, if we want to use that word, of the Trump administration not pushing Congress hard enough, or Speaker Johnson not pushing the conference hard enough, or simply that the Republican Party just isn't there by and large to say, let's remove some of these line items. I mean, I was talking on radio earlier this week about the NPR case and how they're litigating over the separation of powers issue because Trump issued this executive order saying that he wants to cut funding to NPR, and conservatives may be saying, you know, woohoo to that, but it likely is a violation of the separation of powers, and that the simple solution would be for Congress to simply stop appropriating funds. But Trump feels like he has to go and do these things because Congress just simply isn't doing it. And so where are we at with the fault lines?
Well, I think that the problem in the Congress is that the leadership is somewhat weak. And by that, I mean, you know, part of the genius of a Nancy Pelosi is that she could take a very narrow Democratic majority and whip everybody into shape so that she would not only have the votes, but be able to count the votes before the votes occurred. The Republican Party is not like that. You've got two tail ends with the conservatives on the one side and then just a bunch of sort of very weak-kneed Republicans on the other side. And so, for example, there is a kind of a New York faction of Republicans in the House that have been pushing for the deductibility of state and local taxes off of the federal return, right? This is the so-called SALT issue, state and local taxes issue. And so the problem is that, you know, liberal states like New York can have very high state taxes, and then you get to take it off of your federal return and, in a sense, put the cost on people all around the country who are not in New York. So this is obviously, from a fiscal point of view, a very bad thing to encourage. And yet the New York faction is going to hold out because they are like, hey, there's a narrow majority, and that gives us a lot of bargaining power to essentially hold the bill hostage. If you don't give us this deduction for our constituents, then we're not going to vote for the bill. So this is what really ends up happening, is when you have a substantial majority, you can say, okay, well, you take a hike. We don't need your vote. We'll punish you in other ways. But on the other hand, when you have a very narrow majority, you have to give in to every rebel faction that wants to extort something out of you.
Mm. And unfortunately, I mean, Speaker Johnson has talked about Congress being a team sport in a sense. And this is what we're seeing because we don't have a king in America that is vested with, you know, the legislative, executive, and judiciary power all in one person. You have some of these other problems with legislation that are by definition, I think, good comparatively, but you have the problems of all of these different factions of trying to get along, trying to have this kind of cohesive majority. But it seems like when the Democrats are in power, somehow they're in lockstep, but then Republicans have such a wide differential of their perspectives and their pet issues and all that, that it's very difficult to all get on the same page, even on something that should be pretty obviously conservative, like a better budget and like reducing spending. And to me, this really shouldn't have been this complicated. So if we go back to Elon for just a moment, Dinesh, is it your perspective and view that he's just that frustrated with Republicans for not seeing how easy and attainable some of these wins are? And this is why he's kind of saying, all right, I'm out.
I mean, you have to marvel at the stupidity of the Republican Party, right? Because if the Republican Party had even partially jumped on Doge and just said, listen, let's just take the 10 most egregious things, pass a bill right now, institutionalizing them, boom. Then we'll take the next 10 most egregious things and we'll just keep doing this. Elon would be all over it. He would be bankrolling all these Republicans in the midterm. But the Republicans are so dug in to all this and so unwilling that, you know, I think they think that, hey, if we open up the kind of Doge cabinet, then all kinds of spending that we have been forking in that benefits us, benefits our own reelection, benefits our district, all of that comes under scrutiny. Suddenly someone wants to know, why are you building this bridge to nowhere? why are you handing out this money to groups that don't really do anything? That suddenly all of it becomes open to inspection. So the Republicans are like, we just don't want to open that Pandora's box. And Elon goes, well, then why am I putting myself on the line when none of you are willing to take any kind of risk or any kind of responsibility whatsoever? I will just focus on, this is very much Elon's temperament, let me focus on something where I can actually make a difference. And so it's like he's pulled back into SpaceX and in Tesla, the Boring Company, you know, his projects in AI. I think he feels like, you know, there are fewer obstacles in getting those things done. He probably thinks at this point it's going to be easier to get to Mars than it is to cut the federal budget.
Yeah, which is quite the tagline, right? It's easier to get to Mars than cut the federal budget. I think you need to put that on a hat or a T-shirt or something. I would wear that. But so where do we go from here then? I mean, is this going to be this term going to see some wins or overall, do you think that conservatives by the end of Trump's term? And I know we're projecting years out, and who knows what could happen. But will conservatives think, wow, Congress really just didn't do anything, and now we're not really better off under the 4 years of Trump? I mean, you know, maybe because we didn't have 4 years of Kamala. Certainly we're avoiding all of that. But we're not as ahead as where we should have been.
The job of conservatives is to articulate, I think, to the American people that these are the choices in front of us. And that if we choose this course of action, this will be the consequence. And so, for example, let's just look at what will happen if the United States keeps adding $2 or $3 trillion each year to the debt. The debt goes from 38 to 40 to 50 to 75 to 100 trillion. It now begins to equal the entire assets of the United States. And what I mean is all the land, all the buildings, all the cars, all the stuff that we have in this country added together begins to be dwarfed by the debt. In other words, the whole country is bankrupt, not just the government, the country itself. Now, the government can't allow that in a certain sense. So what do? They end up essentially going to the money printer and printing another $100 trillion, which basically destroys the U.S. dollar, destroys the purchasing power of your money and mine, generates a hyperinflation that it's difficult to get out of. And so you create a certain type of economic ruin. And it's not just that this happens, quote, in the future. It's happening now because the government is printing money now. And as a result of that printing, they're diluting the savings of young people who are trying to buy a house. You know, if you want to know, like, why are home prices going up so fast? The correct answer is they're actually not going up at all. The value of your money is going down. And that's the result, that's the 100% fault of the U.S. government printing money. So we are in this predicament now, and the question before the American people is, are you going to elect people who will help us get out of it, or do you want to sort of drive this car off the cliff? Ultimately, that is a question for Congress, but it's also a question for the American people.
It is a question for the American people, because very soon we're going to be facing the midterms. And so in just the last few minutes I have with you, Dinesh D'Souza, I think that really is going to be the question. Are Americans, by and large, sick enough of the rhino Republicans and the people who aren't willing to implement the Trump mandate as the American people articulated it and perceived it and elected in November of 2024, are they going to be tired enough of that we will reshape Congress and the Senate in November of next year? Or is it going to be kind of the same where we complain about this, but then ultimately, you know, elect the same type of people and we just never get anything done?
Well, one of the things I've noticed on the ground, partly this is the result of just looking closely at my son-in-law Brandon Gill's campaign, is that I understand that in certain kind of purple states or purple districts of America, you get a Susan Collins, who is a Republican but representing the liberal state of Maine, and so you get somebody who's kind of a weak-kneed Republican. What I don't understand are the Lindsey Grahams, the Mitt Romneys of the world. Because think about it, if you had rock solid conservatives in South Carolina or in Utah, they're going to win those elections anyway. So somehow the Republican Party tends to produce these so-called rhino figures, even in deep red districts and deep red states. That is a puzzle, but it's answered in part by noticing that a lot of times the kind of MAGA or even the conservative candidate is full of enthusiasm, but doesn't have the ingredients necessary to be able to win the election, notably money, but also organization. Weirdly, the rhinos, who are not very good at governance, are actually very good at campaigning and raising money. And so what you have is these guys are able to win even in districts where a much more conservative candidate would be acceptable, but none seems to show up credibly on the scene.
Well, it's definitely going to be a very interesting midterm, and I think the difficulty for Trump moving forward, if he wants to implement his agenda, is going to try to get Congress at least on the same page with some of this that they have to codify in order for this to be an enduring win, not just a very temporary executive order that may even be thrown out by the judiciary before he even leaves office. So, Dinesh, really appreciate your thoughts on this. And, you know, maybe closing thoughts on how effective do you think Elon was, at least in the court of public opinion, even if not all of the Doge uncoverings and agenda actually gets implemented? I think this has at least raised in the public conscience and the overall media commentary and focus on these issues how reckless the spending actually has been, because we have tangible and concrete data where it was a little bit more esoteric previously.
I mean, Elon's accomplishments in the political sphere are mammoth. I mean, this guy essentially single-handedly saved free speech through the X platform. This is a guy who I think helped get Trump elected. This is a guy who has exposed so much that now that we see it, we can't unsee it. So regardless of whether something is done about it, we all know about it. And so I think his foray, if you want to call it that, has already been tremendous. I think his goals are a little different than Trump. Trump's goal, basically, I think, with this big bill is to have a big win, a win in the House, a win in the Senate, and then to move on to other things, to take this bill, even though it has some kind of, you know, lesser evil type of components, to say, all right, we have to live with those and kind of move on to the next barricade, because ultimately this isn't just a single battle, it's a larger war. So I'm kind of willing to extend some rope to the Trump administration while it's doing that. I mean, this spending problem is not new to Trump. It, of course, goes back to the days of FDR, and the massive escalation of spending really came under COVID. We need to get back to sort of pre-COVID type of numbers, but it doesn't look like we're going to do that, at least not this time around.
Well, well said, Dinesh D'Souza. And where can people find your podcast and listen to your further commentary on Elon as I did this week?
Well, thanks, Jenna. Well, the podcast is in audio on Google and Spotify, and it's up on in video on YouTube and Rumble, also on the Salem Media platform. So I'm excited to be doing that every day, and also check out my books and movies.
Absolutely. I love all of your work and your commentary. Thanks so much for dropping by the podcast today. And, you know, these are really important issues, and I'm glad we got to do this deep dive. So for all of our AFR family, you can always reach me and my team with topics, suggestions, and guests that you'd like to hear from, Jenna at AFR.net. And I will see you next Friday.